Top scientist James Lovelock explains his Gaia theory, how life on Earth manipulates the climate. Lovelock also explains why he thinks we have tipped the climate irrevocably into a new hot state. He foresees a calamitous reduction of the human population and a mass migration toward the poles, where the Earth will still be habitable for humanity. This speech was recorded by Radio Adelaide on July 7, 2007, as part of their Festival of Ideas. Find that at www.radio.adelaide.edu.au.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to this session of the Adelaide Festival of Ideas. My name's Duncan Steele. I'm a member of the Advisory Committee. This afternoon is one of those times when it would be very polite as such of me to read out the many, many accomplishments of this afternoon's two speakers. However, it would be impolite. I would be using up their time, using up your time in doing so. So I'm just going to simply introduce them and let them get on with it. This is a relatively short session. It's only 45 minutes long. We're going to use it all up for discussion between Tim Radford and James. So please welcome Tim Radford and James Lovelock.
Because we have so little time, I shall simply say that I'm an English reporter who has known and indeed read the books of James Lovelock for many years. I shall also say that he has a new book out, and a slightly apocalyptic one. I will also say that if you attended the first lecture in this Festival of Ideas by Norman Swan, you will have gained the idea that our life expectancy is increasing. Such that had we held this meeting 150 years ago, most of us would not be here. If you then went to James's address last night in the town hall, you would have also had the distinct impression that if we held this lecture 50 years from now, most of you would not be here, because we seem to be at a very lucky time, poised between plenty and death on a massive scale. This is, by the way, a gross reading of the first pages of The Revenge of Gaia. What we're going to talk about is how we got into this situation, and also, more interestingly, how it is that a scientist, working by himself most of his life, came to identify some of the great atmospheric crises of the last half a century. That is, there's quite a lot of feedback. Can you hear? Great. That is, detectors devised by James Lovelock actually identified, I started to write them down and then got bored with it, carcinogenic hydrocarbons, PCBs, dioxins, chlorofluorocarbons. You can blame the ozone crisis on him if you like, indirectly. James, where did all this start? I mean, at what point did you go from being a medical researcher to a physical chemist and someone who actually could actually read the signatures of past chemistry in the atmosphere?
Well, I suppose, Tim, really, I've been a physical chemist all along, and they put me into medical research to kind of keep the biologists honest. As my boss put it to me just before moving me into one group of biologists, they don't know one end of a thermometer from the other. Yeah. Make sure they do good science. So that really is why I looked at the problems from that angle. I discovered that detector you mentioned, the electron capture detector, quite by accident. I wasn't looking for it. I wasn't out to save the planet or something, even then. It was the way one was allowed to do science in the old days, by being curious and looking at an interesting problem. And quite often it wasn't the problem itself that led to the winner. It was some sort of sideline that nowadays the managers would say to you, oh no, don't follow that up, you must keep your eyes focused on the main thing.
But was the sideline?
Well, I was making a detector for Archer Martin. He was a famous scientist who had invented gas chromatography, and his method was not quite sensitive enough, and he needed something better. I was doing reasonably well on that, and I kept noticing some very odd effects that certain substances, like pesticides, gave a very strong signal in the opposite direction. And I thought this was worth investigating, and that's what led me off onto a sidetrack that became the electron capture detector.
How sensitive did the detector need to be? I mean, what kind of figures are we talking about?
Well, roughly speaking, when Archer Martin made his gas chromatograph, the only detectors available, and the best one was one he invented himself, called a gas density balance, could detect about 1 in a million. What happened, the one I was trying to make to a replacement would have detected 1 in a billion. And
right.
That would have been ideal for
yes.
me. And after a while, I made it, and it worked. And the first gas chromatographs used it. But the electron capture detector was something quite special. That went way beyond the part per trillion. So it was...
And how did you test these things?
That was one of the most difficult things, because there's almost no way of making a standard, that's a dilution. Take no notice of what the homeopaths tell you. If you try diluting something down to a part per trillion, you can't do it. There's always enough of it floating around by accident that it contaminates the sample you're trying to make, and you can never really get there, so you're lost. Well, being a physical chemist helped, because I could work out from the signal itself how many electrons had reacted with the molecules, and therefore know how much it was detecting.
Did you take this somewhere to... what was your first target chemical?
First?
Target chemical. When you said, I now wish to detect something at a proportion of a part per trillion. That, by the way, is one part per million.
It was carbon tetrachloride. Back in those days, they used it in all fire extinguishers.
Yeah.
It was a pretty standard thing, and also as a solvent in the house for, you know, getting out grease stains and things like that. It wasn't until quite a bit later they discovered it was singularly poisonous and actually carcinogenic.
Yeah. So was that one of your early victims, as it were, of toxic research?
In a way, yes, yeah. Yes.
And how did you get on to... What persuaded you to start looking for chlorofluorocarbons?
Oh, well, that was very interesting. It was donkey's years later. I was living in the country in Britain, about 120 miles west of London. And when I was a boy, that sort of part of the world was... The skies were wonderfully clear in the summer, and you could, on a clear night, see the Milky Way. It's just like the skies down here in Australia. You can see the stars. But gradually, as Europe developed, the air grew hazier and hazier and smoggier, until sometimes during the summer, the haze was so thick you couldn't see much more than 200 yards. It was almost like a fog. And I went to see the meteorologists at, in those days, I think they were at Bracknell, which is a place near London, and asked them what it was. And they said, oh, it's some natural phenomenon coming out of the ground, some form of mist. But I didn't think it. I thought it smelt and looked to me like Los Angeles smog.
Mm. Mm.
And how could I prove it? Well, you could look for things like sulfur dioxide, ozone, all sorts of things like that in it, but it wouldn't prove that it wasn't local. And then it suddenly dawned on me, everywhere there's industry or households, they're using the chlorofluorocarbons in refrigerators, spray cans, all sorts of things. So if I could detect those easily, then there was much more of them in the smoggy air. It meant it was coming from great big city, collections, urban areas. And sure enough, I found that when the smog came thickened, up rose the CFCs, and this pretty well proved that they were of urban origin and not something coming out of the ground locally.
Yeah.
And this was true even of far western Ireland. I don't know if you know the geography of our part of the world, but Western Ireland sticks right out into the Atlantic, kind of pointing at America. And the air normally is exceedingly clear there, but every so often the European smog moves over. And sure enough, when it does, up goes the CFCs.
At the time, were CFCs thought to be dangerous in any way?
No, nobody. You see, when they were first made, they were made by a man called Midgley. Mm. He invented them. And he put, one of his objectives was something to put in a refrigerator as the working fluid that would be totally non-toxic and also completely uninflammable and unreactive, so that it would last the life of the refrigerator. And he really did produce something that met all those needs. And the CFCs are so non-poisonous that some of them you could bath your baby in and it wouldn't matter. You don't even drown in them if you were unfortunate enough to sink below the surface, because they dissolve enough oxygen to keep your lungs happy. This has been demonstrated with mice.
Yes, Midgley actually demonstrated it by breathing it through a mask.
Yeah.
And then breathing out again with no harm. But at that stage, was there already alarm about the condition of the ozone layer, or did that come later?
No, that didn't come until I'd been on a voyage to Antarctica and back on a small ship called the Shackleton. And the reason I went on the voyage, I love ships, and I was desperate for an excuse to go on a nice long ship voyage. And I thought of this idea, well, if I measure these CFCs in the air during this voyage, it would be a way of measuring how much the air in the northern hemisphere mixes with the air in the southern hemisphere, which is one of the things all the geophysicists wanted to know, because we knew how much was being released into the northern hemisphere, so it was a simple calculation to work out from the ratio of the concentrations just how much mixing was going on in the atmosphere. So I set off on this ship, measured them all the way right down and back again, and published it as a little paper in Nature. I made the biggest boo-boo in my life, because at the beginning of the paper I stated, these substances represent no conceivable danger. And I was thinking of from a poisonous point of view, because a lot of people in those days were so frightened of anything with chlorine in. I was sure that the moment I wrote the paper, somebody would be saying, but there's chlorine in the atmosphere, we'll all get cancer from breathing. And, of course, that's sheer nonsense. But I didn't realise, of course, that what happened to them when they got in the stratosphere and the way that they destroyed ozone. But two very competent chemists in America, Molina and Rowlands, saw my paper and realised that these substances might be a source of free chlorine in the stratosphere, and that would destroy ozone.
The first use of your electron capture detector actually came up with data which inspired Rachel Carson to write Silent Spring. Did you ever meet Rachel Carson?
Yes, I did read her book. Yes, it was most impressive, and I still reread it occasionally, because she writes very well. I can recommend her books, and they're not all about the environment. Mm. Some of them are about the sea.
Yes, the sea around
beautifully
us.
Beautifully written. No, but it's not actually true that I inspired Rachel Carson. What it was, Rachel Carson had this idea that pesticides were killing off birds. You see, her interest was in the natural world, not in people. She rightly supposed that the population of songbirds was gradually declining as a result of agricultural pesticides. And she got a lot of ordinary chemists to measure the amount in birds and things like that. But the problem was they used wet chemical methods that could only measure down to a part per million. And it gets very dodgy below that. And there was endless arguments with industry. Well, was this really enough to account for what was happening? And then along came the ECD, just after she'd published her book, and provided her with accurate measurements at very low levels and showed the pesticides were everywhere in the world, even in the fat of penguins in Antarctica. That sort of thing.
Which brings us neatly to the subject of four books by James on the Gaia theory. This is of course about the subtle interactions between life on Earth and the atmosphere and the rest of the planet. And you are of course famous for the Gaia theory, but I have yet to hear in fine detail how you first got the idea, but I believe it was while you were working for NASA.
Yes, I was very lucky in 1961, which is a long time ago now, think of it, when NASA, the American Space Agency, was only 3 years old itself and working in a set of caravans stuck on the hillside in California. I got the chance of working with them. They called me in because of these detectors. Then they badly wanted something very sensitive to look at both the Moon and Mars, the Moon to see if it was fit for astronauts to go to, and Mars to see if there's life there, if the chemicals on the surface of Mars were consistent with life being there. So this was a wonderful opportunity. I'd read science fiction since I was a kid, and to actually be engaged in a kind of instrument expedition to Mars was an absolute dream. And I never forget the letter that came from NASA. It was almost like a love letter as far as its emotional impact was. So I shot off there and worked with them for quite some time. But the upshot was that somewhere about 1965, we began to know what the composition of the Mars atmosphere was from infrared measurements taken on Earth, and also measurements taken aboard one of the orbiting spacecrafts called Mariner that went round Mars. And we began to see just what sort of dead planet it was. And it appeared to be a planet with an atmosphere composed of almost nothing but carbon dioxide, just traces of nitrogen, oxygen and other gases, utterly different from our Earth. And I began to wonder, what is this difference? Why on Earth here do we have an atmosphere that contains oxygen in abundance, and yet methane, natural gas, is part of it also? Admittedly at a low concentration. But if the amount of methane were different, the atmosphere would be explosive. It's a weird atmosphere. It's a reactive atmosphere. And you can easily calculate, if you've got a mixture of methane and oxygen in a planetary atmosphere and the sun shining on it, just what rate those two gases are reacting with one another and how much must be being made each year to keep them there at a constant level. And the amounts are astonishingly large as soon as you do the sum. And there aren't any processes other than life that can do it. So my first thought, well, this is a grand way of detecting life on other planets. Just measure their atmospheric composition and you can tell whether there's life there or not. And I think NASA aims to do this sometime in the future when they can get a telescope up in space sharp enough to distinguish the atmosphere of a planet around some other star way out in the universe. But for me, it caused me to ask the next question, well, what on Earth regulates it? It has to be kept constant, otherwise nasty things are going to happen. So the only thing that could possibly be regulating the atmosphere seemed to be life at the surface. And the more you looked at it, the more clear it became that the whole of the atmosphere was a regulated system with life an important part of it. And then it came to me that if life can control the composition of the atmosphere, then it can control the climate as well. Because as you well know, if you mess around with the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, it does a lot to the climate. Mm. And we're not the only things that can mess around with it. Microorganisms can. So here was clearly to me a great big system that was almost like something alive regulating itself. And all of this came out in the late 1960s. I think my first paper on it was in 1968. And that was the Gaia hypothesis, it was then called. And at first, scientists were quite happy with it and, you know, curious about it. It wasn't a proven thing, but they were glad to do some more work. And then, for some strange reason, the biologists pounced. They said, this is complete rubbish. We must get rid of it. It's as bad as the creationists. And indeed, one very distinguished biologist who later on became a friend said he was so strongly against it that he called it an evil religion, not science at all.
I think that might be a clue there as to which biologist we're talking about.
Yeah, yes. That's right.
Now, but their objection was it was quite an interesting one. It was that evolutionary control lies with the organism and not with the environment. But your proposition says something a little different.
Well, it was really quite simple. I think Darwin got misled by the geologists around him. They gave him the impression that the environment was always dead constant, which it isn't. And so Darwin assumed that organisms always adapt to the environment. He wasn't allowed to realize that organisms change the environment. Dash it all, we're doing that. Mm-hmm. Organisms have always changed the environment. And the moment they have the ability to change the environment, then that alters their competition with other organisms. They could change it in a way that knocks off their competitors and so on.
So a coral...
It's part of evolution, in other words.
A coral reef, of course, is an alteration of the environment, and so is a motorway.
Yeah, that's right. Anything we do, or they do.
You got into trouble quite early on because it sounded as though you were taking science into another direction. I mean, do you suppose the word Gaia was part of the problem?
Well, the word Gaia all came about because I lived in a village in southern England, in Wiltshire, and a near neighbour of mine was the author William Golding, Lord of the Flies and The Spire and those things. Very famous author. He was, strangely enough, had been trained in physics when he went to university, although he dropped it when he took up writing. But he was very interested in what I was up to at NASA back in those days. And when I told him about this idea, he said, well, you better give it a good name or nobody will take it seriously. And then he said, well, I suggest you call it Gaia. And this was in a walk to the post office. We went on walking for 20 minutes. I thought he was talking about G-Y-R-E, one of these great self-regulating worlds in the ocean. And then they said, no, I mean Gaia, the Greek goddess. So it got stuck. When you get offered a name by a novelist of his quality, you don't lightly give it up.
Yes. What was the first evidence that you produced that actually began to convince people that this wasn't just a pleasant metaphor?
Well, one of the side lines of that voyage I made that found the CFCs, I also measured the ocean all the way from the north to the south of the planet to see if two compounds, or rather if there were compounds that contained the elements iodine and sulfur, because I knew that these were in very short supply on the land, and yet vegetation needs them, or rather vegetation needs the sulfur and we animals need the iodine. And sure enough, all the way, there was a compound, methyl iodide, that's volatile, came off the sea, floated in the air, and would get onto the land. And there was another compound, dimethyl sulfide, that did the same for sulfur. And a friend of mine, Peter Liss, calculated sometime afterwards that they exactly accounted for the balance of sulfur transfer from the ocean to the land and back again. So that was a first example practical example of a bit of self-regulation going on.
The balance could only have existed because something was regulating it.
That's right, yeah. And so it went on.
So we begin with one convincing piece of machinery, but there are others followed.
That's right. And then later on, in the 1980s, I was working with a scientist in America who was interested in why clouds form. Now, you might think that when the water evaporates from the ocean, it's going to condense, and that's how there are clouds. But apparently, he told me, that's not so. If the air were completely clean, the water would go up, it would condense all right, but as giant droplets that would fall straight out from a clear blue sky, not as rain or mist or clouds. And to form clouds, you have to have tiny nuclei, as they call them, little particles floating in the atmosphere on which the water can condense and form the cloud droplets of clouds. He couldn't find anything. And so I said, well, what are these tiny droplets? Because I knew he'd measured them. And it turned out they were tiny droplets of sulfuric acid or of ammonium sulfate. And I said, well, surely that comes from pollution. He said, no, it couldn't possibly get that far out over the Pacific, mid-Pacific, because it would fall out of the air before then. And then it suddenly dawned on me that dimethyl sulfide coming off the ocean would oxidize in the air and form just these particles. And so we now had what was the natural source of clouds. The clouds were being made by the organisms living in the oceans. And that was a very big addition to the Gaia notion.
And at that point it gets dramatic because it becomes clear that any one species could actually disrupt the system if it started pumping chemicals into the atmosphere at an undue rate.
Well, I think, and this is pure speculation, so don't repeat it outside this hall. and that is, the geologists have found what they call, there was a snowball Earth.
Yes.
The Earth nearly froze solid, and we somehow got out of it. My guess is that this happened when the organisms first learnt to make this dimethyl sulfide stuff. You see, well, at the moment, only 0.1%, 0.1% of the amount of it they make gets into the air. The rest is eaten by other organisms in the ocean. Now, the first time that the organisms learnt to make it, there wouldn't have been any things around to eat it. So it just poured forth like mad into the air, and the whole planet clouded up solid, reflected sunlight to space, and just cooled right down till it was a snowball Earth.
So how did it get out of the mess that it found itself in then? This was, 700 million years ago?
Something like that. Yeah. Well, my guess is that organisms learnt to eat it. After all, it was food lying around there in the ocean, and as soon as they did, the balance was struck again.
So regulation returned, but slowly.
That's right. It might have been relatively quickly.
Yes. We are now engaged in an even more relatively quick game, in that the last 150 years or so has seen an astonishing discharge of material into the atmosphere.
That's right.
And it can be no secret, even in this hall, that you think that we could be heading into trouble at enormous speed.
Yes, indeed. Almost as bad as a snowball Earth, but in the opposite direction, getting very hot. There are two possible cheery bits to that story, if you like to look at it that way. One is, don't take the IPCC, that's the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change's models, too seriously. I think they're the best that scientists can do at the moment. But what they show is that the more CO2 goes in the air, the higher the temperature gets. And they're predicting by the end of the century it may go up as much as 8 degrees Celsius, which would be pretty devastating if that's the average for the whole planet. We really would be in trouble. But if you look back on the Earth's history, you find times when accidentally large amounts of carbon dioxide went into the atmosphere. And when that happened, the temperatures didn't rise up right to 8 degrees. They leveled off at about 5 degrees up and stabilized again and remained regulated there. And at the last event of that kind was 55 million years ago. And when it happened, most of the Earth went to desert, like the Great Australian Desert. But it was okay up in the Arctic, and life had time to move up there. It may have been okay in the Antarctic in those days too, but we don't have too much evidence about that. But it stayed up in those northern and southern regions until it cooled off again. But it took 200,000 years to cool. So there's no great extinction. Life went up there and then moved back again. And the same, I think, will happen again.
Except that there may be some extinctions nonetheless. We, for instance, could be victims. Or will we survive?
We'll survive. We're one of the toughest animals on Earth. And so will Gaia. The whole system survives. So it's not all bad, but it's a pretty rough event. But on the other hand, don't forget, we've been as a species on the planet for nearly a million years now, and there have been 7 incidents nearly as bad as that during that million years. And that's every time we move from an ice age to an interglacial like now. There's a temperature rise about the same as will happen this century. And we've survived through all of that, so I reckon we'll survive through this one. But there will be an enormous cull if as much as 20% of us remain after 2100, we'll be lucky.
Yeah, something to think about. Before we get on to what we might do about it, does Gaia have a preferred state? If you left Gaia, I'm using this as a metaphor only. I don't believe there's a goddess managing the business, and nor does James. How would she like the Earth to be? Would she like it to be warm, cool, moderate?
Cold as possible.
Right.
And the ice age is a comfortable state for the planet. You see, the problem is the sun has been steadily getting hotter ever since life began on Earth. It's now about 30% hotter than it was at the origin of life. And it must have been okay at the origin of life, the temperature on the planet, or it wouldn't have started, it wouldn't have populated. So what tends to happen with regulating systems is that they tend to run at a temperature the opposite of what they're being forced towards. So the hotter it gets, the colder it tries to run. So the system's happiest when it's cold in an ice age.
We're not going to manage that in a hurry, though. So we'll have to think of something else to do if we want to stay alive. If we want to stay comfortable, or if we want to preserve civilization. Now I know that you've actually proposed that we should use nuclear power as a stopgap until we come to terms with life. This is, of course, a decision that countries take, not scientists. So it's not actually our business. But the subtext of that, no, probably the major text of that, is that science and technology and technological development in particular got the human race into this position where it actually, we now have 9 billion people all with a life expectancy of 80 plus. Science and technology certainly identified the problems coming ahead. Do you think science has got any answers at all for managing the future crises?
Well, I hope so. I mean, otherwise, it's not been a very satisfactory life to have led. Yes, I think there are things to do. You will certainly find that when things get tougher in about 10 or 20 years, the United States, which is a very can-do nation, is going to say, but we've got to fix this. And obviously, there are several things they can do. They can put up sunshades in space that shield sunlight away from the Earth. It's not as crazy as it sounds, and there are schemes worked out for doing that. But whether they will ever do it, the international fuss there would be is almost unbearable, because these things would not only be, so to speak, cooling us off, but they're potential weapons too. That raises all sorts of hackles. A much more practical way is to just get the airlines to dump a bit of sulfur in the stratosphere as they fly along. And they don't need much, about 1 ton per long-distance flight. This is enough to put a strong sulfate aerosol in the stratosphere that would reflect sunlight back and keep us reasonably cool. The problem there is, of course, we would then go on doing what we're still doing, and the CO2 would go on rising, and then life in the sea would die, and all sorts of other nasty things happen.
Why would life in the sea die?
Because CO2 is an acid in many ways, and once the sea gets too acid, then organisms like shell-forming organisms can't form their shells, and there's just mayhem would be released in the whole of the ocean. So that's not a good... The way I look at it, those kind of answers are a bit like when your kidneys fail, you're going to die, but you can go on dialysis. And dialysis will keep you alive for quite a while, but it's not really living. Not unless you've got a transplant kidney waiting. Well, there isn't a transplant ocean waiting for the Earth. So it's only a temporary answer. The only hope I can see of a permanent answer is to get one of the great systems of the Earth to go into reverse. At the moment, nearly all of the systems that should be causing cooling are actually adding to the heating, making things worse. And the best system to work on is the ocean, and for two reasons. One, it's the biggest system on Earth. It's 70% of the surface. And secondly, there's nobody lives there, so you're not going to have any politics involved. And what you could do is the reason the ocean's gone sour for us at the moment is that once the water gets over 14 Celsius, which is not very high, it forms a stable floating layer on top into which nutrients from below can't circulate. And as a consequence, the algae die or almost die, and you could look at the ocean as a desert. And you can see this yourselves. If you go anywhere in the tropical waters, it's beautiful, clear and blue, and you can see right down. It's clear and blue because there's nothing living there. If you go to polar waters, they look like soup. They're so thick, and you can't see through them at all because they're full of life. So if we could mix in the cooler waters from below, which contain loads of nutrients, with the hot water above, then the algae would grow again, start blooming. They would then pump down the carbon dioxide, make the cloud gas, and help cool the planet. How do we do it? It mightn't be that difficult. With enough pipes, just plastic pipes going down 100 meters, and using the wave energy, the waves as they come over, with a flat valve at the bottom of the pipes, water would keep coming up continuously, and perhaps it might do it.
There we are. A whole Earth solution. at least extended across 70% of the planet, with, I would have thought, a lot of jobs involved as well, so... because that would keep a very large number of people busy.
Yes, especially in Australia.
Yes. It would, however, consume quite a lot of energy. And that's the second problem. We're a civilization that... We're all here because of petrol and electricity. And so we have to go on providing some for ourselves somehow.
Well, if you use the remaining oil supplies to build plastic pipes... it's not going to put CO2 in the air, is it?
That's true. But I like the sound of that answer. You very quickly became a patron saint, a saint to the Greens, but your relationship with them has always been a little bit awkward because you are a physical chemist and you fail to see that these things are dangerous?
Largely, the Greens are wonderfully well-intentioned, very humane and decent people, liberal in their thoughts, but they're not very good scientists. They will tend to pick solutions which are very unscientific indeed.
So what we need is actually more... We don't just need more education, we need more thought, I think is the lesson here. Right. Now, you haven't stopped. You're still doing science.
Oh, heavens, yes. You've got to keep busy.
Yes. What is preoccupying you now, apart, of course, from saving the planet?
writing the next book?
Oh, yes, yes. You can go to a tent near here and buy this book. I'm just telling you, you can actually buy a cheaper edition than this one. This is a hardback.
Working on these pipes.
Yes. Oh, yes. You have actually. And the other my other question was your relationship with the scientific establishment, because that too has been up and down for a long time.
Well, they don't like somebody who's not one of the cronies amongst the group. Mm. You see, science is divided into so many specialties now. There's 30 different biologists, for example. And to give you an example of how bad it is, if you go out in the field somewhere and find an intriguing-looking flower, I'll bet this is what would happen if you take it along to your local university and go and ask to see the professor of biology and ask him what it is. He'll look at it and say, that's a very interesting thing. Yes, he said, I'm afraid I can't help you there. It's not really my field. You see, I'm a molecular biologist. What you'd better do is go along and see the professor so-and-so, who's the botanist. He's got the next office to me. So you go along to him and you show it to him. He said, oh, that's a wonderful thing, that. But I wish I knew what it was. You see, I can't tell you because I'm a cryptogamic botanist. What you want is an ordinary botanist. We don't have one in the university. And it just goes on like that. They're all divided up into specialties, and they're almost proud they know nothing about the other specialties. And that's true of physics as well as biology. It's true of chemistry, the whole darn boiling. It's not surprising we're in a bit of a mess.
What made you different? I mean, there must have been... you started, like everyone in science, you started in a research institution. In fact, one that you've just reminded me actually achieved 6 Nobel Prizes.
Yeah.
And you left. But why did you leave? And why did you want to be independent?
Oh, because I was employed there as a civil servant, and there was a permanent job. Short of raping the director's daughter on the lawn in front of everybody, getting the media there as well, I was safe in my job until retirement. And I could see tram lines, the security going on all the way down to retirement with a decent pension and the grave. I didn't like it. It didn't seem like a life to me. So I thought, oh, we've got to break and go independent. And
but you then went on to Texas and a university job there.
Well, that was just a temporary thing while I was working at NASA.
Oh, right. So all your work at NASA was on a contract basis. You
That's right.
Yes. Mm. But, of course, they put you in charge of a project.
I know, that was scary.
Tell them.
Well, the idea that you could use atmospheric analysis to tell whether there's life on a planet so appealed to NASA, still does, that they actually set up a whole mission called Voyager back in the 60s then and made me kind of overall manager of it. Well, I'm not a manager. I can barely manage myself. If it weren't for my wife, Sandy, who's in the audience, I probably wouldn't be here today. I'd have gone somewhere else. And after about 3 months, I was really scared, because once you're manager of a big project with hundreds of millions of dollars flowing around, it's amazing how many crooks come out of the woodwork. I would have finished up in jail. But happily for me, Congress suddenly decided they wanted to cut back on space expenditure and canned it. That was it.
And for those who are confused, NASA, ever economical, actually used the name Voyager for another mission, which is still running.
Right. Yes.
I think at that point, you then retreated to a country estate.
That's right. Well, not a country estate, just a cottage in a village.
Planted 20,000 trees.
That was later.
Oh, right, yes. Yeah. And it would be nice to say was never heard of again, but actually started to be heard of with greater frequency. That was about the point at which the British press, of which I am a mere representative, suddenly discovered Lovelock and kept pestering him. I will now stop pestering you, Jim, and thank you very much indeed, and thank you too for being a great audience.
Thank you, James. Thank you, Tim. James Lovelock will be speaking again at the Adelaide Festival of Ideas tomorrow morning at 10:30, here in Bonython Hall, about the sustainable retreat. Please do come along then.
You have been listening to scientist James Lovelock being interviewed for the Adelaide Festival of Ideas. The speech was recorded by Radio Adelaide on July 7, 2007, and you can find that at www.radio.adelaide.edu.au. That's radio.adelaide.edu.au.